Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. If I was to go to one of the ambassador's parties and was standing there, and I have been to an ambassador's party, actually, now I think about it, but that's a wholly different story, and there were no certain chocolates there. But that is the sort of thing that I would want at a she-she ambassador's party, white tuxes, women in those sort of gorgeous 80s backless dresses, and the man, and that would be the backing track, and the man who knows all about that, because he has travelled far and wide, and he tells us in his new tome, which is called Go Quicker, Sound Slower, he tells us about the exciting, unpredictable, and quite bonkers world of the jobbing actor, in specifically the voiceover actor he was on once before, talking about his father. And for some strange reason, he wanted to come back again. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's Jonathan Kidd. Jonathan, hello again.
A delight, Charles. A delight to be on again. Thank you for having me. I'm sure I was very down a list and you went, oh, all right, then I suppose we'll get him back on.
There's a dartboard in the production studio.
Oh, it's that, is it?
Yeah. And we all get those big dart blowpipe, you know, like,
yes,
and once again, because you're a fellow blue, it came up like that. So therefore, now, last time we had you on talking about your dad, just for those who don't know, you know, how's your father? Who was your father? Because he was rather brilliant.
Yes, he was. Thank you very much for saying that. Yes, I've got this. He described as a legend the other day, which was very nice for somebody to say that. He died in 1982, so people really, unless they're very ancient, don't really know who he is. But he made over 290 films, which should be in the Guinness Book of Records. I've got to tell them they've got Christopher Lee down there as making the most films of any British actor. But it was my dad, 290 plus, hundreds and hundreds of tellies, an era where there are only two channels. So if you're in a big series, which he was, called Crane, for example. There's lots of big series, but one was called Crane. 19 million people watching it. So consequently, the following day in the street, you get mobbed. He was mobbed. I used to wander around with him a little. The words were, keep close, keep close, keep close. People would rush up. And people would say this bizarre thing, which I never understood, which was, lend us a quid, Sam, people would say frequently, as if you would ever be able to see them again to get the quid back from them. But so lend is almost as if it was, you know, you're a TV star, therefore you must be minted, which of course was rubbish.
We lived
in rented accommodation. But also the fact that somehow you'd meet them again and they'd give you the pound back. But this really made an impression on me when I was little. Lend us a quid, Sam. Never understood it. Anyway, but he was a big star, big iconic films, movies, Treasure Island, but he was the first pirate to be killed in that one.
Indeed.
But he played a pirate called Cady with very attractive wig that he had. And I've got all the stills. I've got my mother left an enormous archive of masses of scripts, he used to write things on betting slips. He was a betting man, my dad. He'd write little stories and you'd say, oh, that's an interesting story. And I compiled it all together in letters to them, between them, and diaries, of course. And I compiled the very first book I wrote about him, which was in fact based on his autobiography, which was never published. So I used that as the core with some funny stories in it and added stuff from his diaries and stuff from these betting slips and whatever. And it sold about 3,000. It's done very well, actually.
Great.
And I then republished a book he wrote about being a prisoner of war, which sold 50,000 in 1973, which is actually a great book. It's really, because it's a soldier captured and then forced to do slave labor by the Nazis, which really people didn't ever talk about. It was something that even the soldiers themselves, when they came back, didn't want to talk about. It something weird about the psyche, and it was almost as if you admitted that you'd to be captured early on was a little bit shameful. People didn't, and all they did was the Nazis just made them work on making roads, making big theaters for Nazi propaganda, working in the fields, coal mining as well, carrying emptying barges. They were just slave labor, hardly fed. And then slowly but surely, he was there for 5 years. He wrote this really great book, which is it's amusing. It's called For You, the War is Over. Mm. And it's amusing in the midst of this awfulness. And he escaped, and all the Russians were advancing, almost killed them all, because the idea was you don't speak German. The moment you tried to speak German to the Russians, they'd shoot you because they thought you were German. So he had all of that going on. Then he got back and he became the actor that I've written about in the first book. And I'm now actually at the moment writing the second volume, which is 1953 to 60, when he was in another 100 films, but hundreds of tellies, even the burgeoning television that was particularly ITV, which had only just started then, and he worked a lot for. So there's a lot of telly stuff in there. So you have the people on Talking Pictures TV, which is the channel that people watch the old films. They know of him. I've sold books to them. I've sold it to also people from, people knowing the history of film seem to be very interested in him. But it's also a living that the first book is coming back as a soldier and then living in London from 1945 to 52 is actually quite a good example of what it was like to live in London at the time, you know, just after you've been demobbed from the war, you know.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, a lot of actors who came on to be big screen names,
yes,
a lot of them didn't talk about their service as well. I mean, you mentioned Christopher Lee, and I think the problem is that he's not in the book. The reason that he's probably in the Guinness Book of Records is they were frightened to go and say, by the way, Sam Kidd's got your thing, because he would just dispatch them. I mean,
he was a spy, essentially, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he famously said to Jackson, didn't he, about the fact that if you get stabbed in the back, you don't go, ooh, there's just this hiss of air because it's the lungs. And it's like, blimey, O'Reilly. And Niven as well, who's obviously one of my heroes, David Niven, who said, you know, he went to Bastogne and there were 30,000 graves. And he said, Niven, there are 30,000 reasons not to talk about my war service.
Yes. Yes, but interestingly, another one was who you'd think was nothing like that, was a very ineffective, played lots of slightly camp bureaucratic characters, was an actual Richard Wattis.
Yeah.
And he similarly was hand-to-hand combat, was an expert in killing people.
Yes. So you never knew, did you? You'd never
put the two and two together.
But if people see pictures of your father, they'll go, of course, because he was one. And it's interesting to say, because at that time, and we'll get onto your new book, by the way, but no, because there were only a couple of TV channels, and unlike today, yes, you became part of people's lives because you were in their living. And so people really thought they knew you.
Yeah. The number of people who would come up to him and shake his hand, and that he didn't get when I was littler, he hadn't sunk in completely. People would go, I know you, you're Sid James, or I know you, you're Dermot Kelly, aren't you? But later on, it used to be people would come up and just shake him by the hand and say, you've given me great pleasure. And that was rather lovely. And he was also stopped in that we'd be driving. Cabbies in particular would wind down their windows and say, hello, Sam, because he played lots of crooks. You know, burgled anywhere nice recently? Got any good gear? You know, that kind of stuff. And he was very affable, my dad. He would never turn that down. He would never not sign an autograph. He had lots of pictures he'd give out as well. He was a very, his character was almost like every man. Mm. And he came across as being very kind and very accessible. And that was him as a person as well, you know, so.
Here's the thing, I spent an awful lot of time in showbiz Marbella growing up and whatever. So when I was in my teens, I tended to bump into a lot of people who were the sons of famous people, mainly from the world of light entertainment, but they were the sons of, you know, household names. And it can be a tricky one being the son of somebody quite famous, and especially going into the kind of the same profession, Jonathan, because obviously your father's a well-known actor, and you sort of, was it a thing you wanted to do? Did you find, because everybody goes about Nepo babies at the moment, that's the buzzword. Was it something that you wanted to do, or you were surrounded by a creative environment, you didn't want to do exactly what your dad had done, so you thought you'd do something just to be an actor? Or was it a case of, I want to be an actor, but I want to be a working actor, so I'll take whatever I can get?
I think naively, I just thought it would, you know, inevitably happen. But I didn't think it through, which is they wanted me to be a Cockney initially, because he played lots of Cockneys, and he wasn't a Cockney. He'd been to grammar school in Dunstable, and he spoke like me. But he was very good with voices. Mm. He's very good. Characters, so he could play characters like that without any problem. He's caught it like that, but he also spoke, because he was from Belfast originally, he spoke like that a lot of the time as well. We'd go, and all his family were in Chiswick, and they're all in a big house, and he'd turn up and he'd say, he'd say, let's see what my mother's going to be like today, and he'd open the door and he'd say, hello, how are you, mother? instantly switching into his Belfast, and she'd say, "Oh, hello, stranger," she'd say, even though he'd spoke to her on the phone the day before and been seen her on the Sunday. You know, it was almost as if you had to be there every day to qualify for not being a stranger, you know. So when I first started, I did three minders.
Yeah. Did you do drama school? Or did you just sort of?
No, I did a drama degree actually, and I don't quite know what I did, to be honest. Right. I went down the wrong route. I was interested in girls' football and cricket, you know, and music, lots of pop music of the period, and. And I wandered into a drama degree, which I did at Hull University, and I did French as well because I thought I might as well, I did okay in A level. I think that got me in, and I learned sort of because you did half a degree each. I learnt half a degree really. I don't think I came away with any particular skill in either. But it meant that you could be in a position. I think what it's given me doing drama is I go to theatre and watch it and say, well, he's not very good, is he? Or what have they done with the lighting? Or well, they've directed that scene badly, haven't they? And if I'm a miserable bastard, same way we did film courses, film on it, and I constantly look at films and think, well, I don't like the way that's been edited, or I don't understand that. But it has been it's been beneficial. You know, in fact, I think the trouble is it's made me too clever by half.
Right.
And I've got stage and I've said to directors things like, we're all standing in a line here. Could we move around a bit? Could I go over there and do that? And the director, of course, has said things like, I'm happy, Jonathan, be quiet. Or even, as happened to me, constantly putting my hand up and saying, is there a possibility that I remember doing, actually, I was at Chichester doing Shakespeare. I was playing Caliban. I remember saying to the director, look, this bit's, because I knew too much about it. Mm. I remember saying, this bit's a bit dull. I said, this is Shakespeare. This is an old gag from the 17th century. I said, this doesn't work. It's all the drinking stuff. Can we do can I fall over a bit and do stumble and I'll pass him and do a prat four here? And he said, Jonathan, just shut up, be quiet. This is just, you know, look, stop. He said, it's still Shakespeare. I said, it's not funny. I remember saying, it's not funny. He's a guy called Francis Matthews. It's not funny, Francis. It's supposed to be funny. It's going to dip. The whole energy in this scene is going to dip. And he had to have a word with me afterwards. He said, please, could you stop interfering. Let me direct, please. So I think that was the dilemma of doing a drama degree. But, then wandering about sort of doing,
because it tends to be, because I've got very good friends of mine that have crept with the board. So, it's sort of minder, casualty, the bill,
you're doing that, exactly. The bill, I was in the bill twice. I did, what else? Ultimately did Holby City, but that was later. I did Doctors, that was later on. These are all kind of the peripheral, slightly. Everybody, you know, if you've got a decent agent, you'll get an episode of that, you know, and in the end you tell a story about it, but it's not the dilemma with lots of theatre. I found that if you want to become a if you want to kind of make it, you need to have lots of either be in a soap that works, or be in a theatre piece that somehow, on a theatre company, like go with the RSC or I went to Chichester and I did about seven shows there. But the money is, you know, the car park attendant was earning more money than we were. And because I asked him, I remember saying, excuse me, how much are you earning this for moving the barrier for the theatre? And he said, oh, 125 quid a week. I said, oh, I'm making 90.
Yeah.
So, you know, it sort of puts into perspective and you think, I've got to do something else. So, in fact, at the time I was thinking, I'd done lots of shows at Edinburgh. I actually made something of going to Edinburgh and writing comedy. And so I had this weird career of being quite, doing some fringe, lots of fringe work, which was, I didn't pay at all, profit share and whatever. But it got me sort of known in London,
yeah.
And we did a show in Edinburgh, and I was the Perrier Award runner up in 1981 in a review, and I got us a Radio 4 comedy as a consequence of that. So in a sense, it was doing our own show that gave us the impetus. So I would always say to a young actor, you know, do your own stuff if you can, which is what they do anyway, because this was before stand up. This was just Comedies at Edinburgh were shows, essentially. But we lost to Emma Thompson. The Cambridge Footlights were first.
It was a fix, obviously a fix. That was, you know, obviously entitled so and so. You know,
funny you should say that, because they already had a TV contract before they'd even taken part. So, but it was, you know, Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. In fact, we were then
whatever happened to them. We ask ourselves,
who were they? But there's like ignominy. I remember doing a show in London, kind of, you know, best of the fringe, and they were on at 8 o'clock and we were on at 11, and hardly anybody would come and see us because it was 11, you know.
But from fringe and the respect of your peers, which is the important thing, to radio, and hey, this is a media which I'm slightly familiar with, and voice acting and voiceovers, and the thing is, people say, oh well, you just turn up and read a script. It's dead easy. The opposite is true.
Well, funnily enough, I would agree with them. I just
You've completely blown me out of the water, Jonathan. There you go. I was about to say the suffering. I was going to say because I obviously am highly trained.
No. I was going to add a caveat to that. I've got to add an addendum at the bottom, which is that if you have the skill to do it, I never had any idea. I sight read really well. I thought everybody did. I had no idea. You just hand me a script, I can read it. I don't, you know, and I put it into a kind of shape. And I listen to direction. So whether that's that's just a, you know, natural thing you do. You pay attention to the person. Well, unless it's me, of course. And I said things like, "Can I do it like this?" But partly, I think the speed of it, because you've got 30 seconds to do it. If you're doing an ad and you're in a studio and need to save the money, you've really got to be on the ball to do it. You really have to. So I'm underestimating. You really need to be in charge of the situation to be able to read it and get it right. So you've got to have an attitude that means you're going to solve the problem for them for what they're after. This is in commercials, which I discovered I could do really easily. But from an acting point of view, the other thing is that you're saving the money if you can play lots of characters. And I knew that I could play lots of characters because we were doing review all the time. And yet, from an acting point of view, I think to get into the BBC or ITV, unless you went into a sketch show, you weren't considered a proper actor at that period, because I then did the Brian Connolly show for about 4 years, playing lots of different characters. And also, it just so happened that he haven't got any songs. He wanted to sing a lot. He said, "Jonathan, we haven't got any songs." So I ended up writing him 26 songs with a mate, comedy songs, which helped as well. So I became slightly indispensable. I'm sorry, I'm going round in a circle here.
A couple of things on this point is, how quickly do you think, as opposed to what comes out in terms of the voice? Because a lot of people who do scripts think incredibly quickly, so that when they enunciate, they think they're working at half speed, but in fact, it's coming out to normal people as their normal voice. See if you're doing an advert, do you think that you're speaking extremely slowly because your mind's racing?
Never. I frequently have to speak quickly because they've written too many words.
But the change of because it used to be commercials, but now then their video games came along, and that has been something.
Yeah, I've done a lot of them. Yeah, I've done a lot of video. I've done about 100 video games. But the trouble is I never know what I've done. So I tend not to make lists. You know, you get people create a website and a career out of having done two games, and you just look at it and they've got every picture and they've shot themselves now in every session that they've done. And it's fantastic. And they've then got, you know, 100,000 followers on TikTok. Whereas I've done about, 100 games. Can't remember which ones I've done particularly, other than I know I did all the Harry Potter games. I played Hagrid.
Right.
Because Robbie Coltrane was too expensive. Robbie Coltrane's voice, I think, changed as he started off sort of like that, Harry, you know, a bit like that. And after, I think, after about, you know, six films, he was sort of speaking like that, you know, because that's right for him from there. But Hagrid, so I kept thinking, oh, shall I do a variation and make it kind of Scots? West Coast,
So Californian Celt.
Yeah. Well, but also it was that his accent was a kind of a caricature anyway, you know. So because he was very sort of like that was almost piratical at the very beginning, where he said it, and But then also played, I played Peeves the Ghost, which I loved as a character. Potter, where are you? Potter, where are you? Which I always loved that character because you could do that behind children and freak them out if they were watching them, looking at the games, which was a bit cruel to me. And also various portraits and Death Eaters. And my, my favourite line of all of that was, Kosher, put down your wand. Which was, I think, in the final one. And Urklings. There's a thing in the book, actually, about playing the Urkling. And despite going round in a circle in the hour of the job, and the producer saying, can we try another voice? Try a different angle. Let's try this and let's try that. And let's come in, make it some more squeaky. Or can you make your mouth wider? Can we like the same character to characters like that? In the end, the character came through like that. And I said, it sounds a little bit German now. What if it's doing a voice like that? I know we've gone around a complete circle and ended up with a strange German voice for the Urkling. But I had a little song that was nice. But no, and other things, apparently. I went to a film. I'm trying to make a documentary about my dad, actually, and I've made several shorts, which are on my website, jonathankidd.com. And I've also got an idea for a film. I'm going to try and shoot that as well. But I went to a film convention and chatted to some students, and they weren't. They said, what have you done? What have you been in? I said, well, I've done... I've been in a few films in the Bertrand Tavernier film called Laissez Passer. I was in a series of comedy stuff, like lots of ads. Oh, not interested in me. And when I said I've done a few video games, oh, what video games you done? I said I did Harry Potter, Fable. I said Assassin's Creed. What Assassin's Creed were you in? I said I can't remember Unity and another one I was playing. I played Jack the Ripper in one of them, and I was killed. And I do very good death, by the way, Giles. Apparently,
good to know.
Oh, yes. Very good. I don't know where I've got it from. Cartoons or something. I've no idea what, but apparently, and also quick death, because they say this has to be a quick death. So you have to go or something, you know, it's instant there. But, and these kids were immediately, oh my God, you're a star. Oh, wow. Brilliant. Fantastic. Wow. And also I was in Toy Story. I played two characters in Toy Story that time forgot played, which was, I was an armourer. The armourer speaks sort of a bit like that. He was a kind of sort of like fae character like that. But the dinosaur was very dinosaur. So it was,
that's total minder. That's total minder. Listen, right. The book also is not only about what, because I'll ask you about the Ambassador's Party at the end, but I've got 5 minutes, yeah, Johnson. So hang on. It's not only about, you know, and then I did the voice for this and I crept the boards at Chichester, but it's also about the life unseen. And the characters that are in your life as an actor tend to be more interesting than the characters that you play as an actor.
I think that's probably very true, because there's a character loosely based on my mother who wants to make me into a DIY expert on the family home, which is quite funny. In fact, she provided a few of the lines herself for it to be amusing. There's the terrible girlfriend he goes out with, who's the fitness trainer, who falls asleep because she runs the client so often. She falls asleep every time she's out with him into the pudding or whatever cinema they're at. He goes to Chelsea, watches football with Chelsea with his mate Roop, and his mate Roop gets involved in fights and whatever because he's a little bit leery. It's an enormous amount of going to dreadful castings with dreadful actors and dreadful people who are just in the business. And there are several stars in it whose names I've changed to protect
for litigation. The gentleman who spends his professional life dressed as a chicken.
Indeed. Well, exactly right. Yes, yes. That's Derek Fazakerly, yes, who hardly ever works, so just demonstrates in supermarkets and starts having an affair with somebody who he thinks after a bit, because there are two of them dressed as chickens, has got it wrong. And she's just chosen the wrong one to go out with, because he said he didn't think he got on terribly well. But she was dressed as a kumquat, he said, which was quite a revelation.
You had me. Oh, well, actually, I'm not going to say that because it could be misconstrued.
But there are several stars in it who behave appallingly in sessions, and I've written about them. There are the dreadfulness of doing a take quite well, and some 11 people are listening to you, and they suddenly all have an opinion, or even the work experience girl has an opinion, and they go with the work experience idea, and you have to do that. And it's being pushed from pillar to post and running from studio to studio. And there's a whole cartoon series in it called Henry the Hedgehog, where he plays Henry the Hedgehog. In fact, that's all made up because I felt I couldn't actually. There were bits of, I played Paddington Bear for 74 episodes in the 90s, and there were bits of that in it, some of the characters. But similarly, I couldn't have. There really was a bloke in it who used to pull my stand over all the time. Just so I was about to speak, he would wrap his microphone lead round the stand where the script was and pull it and laugh uproariously.
I've got one minute. Okay, so Ferrero Rocher, how do you keep a straight face when you're having to deal with the ambassadors' parties?
The ambassador's receptions are noted in society for their exquisite taste that captivates his guests. Yes, I did that for an agency called Euros. It was supposed to be, they said it'll never go on air because it's got too many different bits in it for pan-European involvement, and it was to be broadcast. It'll never go on air. And the so I did a silly voice. I did Echelente. I did Ambassador Aspiring Us. And they got another woman in called Eve Karp, who was lovely, to do all the women's voices. And the head of Ferrero Rocher said, "We like very much what you are doing. Please, you come back and not be so silly with the main voice." And it went out, and it created, you know, great interest in Ferrero Rocher. But, you know, other than that.
The book is called Go Quicker, Sound Slayer. It's by Jonathan Kidd. Jonathan, where can people find you?
On Amazon. On Amazon and eBay.
Marvellous. And you can order it via our own virtual bookstore. Jonathan Kidd, thank you so much for your time today.